Let me know if you can't hear me. Can't hear me, okay. Try a little harder. It's always inspiring to come out and see how many of you come out here on a Sunday morning to spend your morning learning, and very inspiring. When I spoke to one of my siblings a few months ago, and I originally set the date for this year, and I mentioned to them that I was going to be giving a shiur from Midrash Yom Rishon this year, so the first thing they asked me was, oh, are you speaking about Purim? There's an inside joke in my family, because many years ago, when I came back from learning for 2 years in Israel, the first Shabbos I was back, we were sitting around the Shabbos table, and someone asked me to give a Dvar Torah. I've been gone for 2 years, must have learned so much Torah. Can I please tell them something that I learned over the course of the 2 years? But like when you don't speak to somebody for many weeks or for a long time on the telephone, and when you finally speak to them, what do you talk about? You can't tell the mundane things. You can't tell the little things. So after spending 2 years learning in Israel, I had no idea what to say, what to choose for a Dvar Torah at the Shabbos table. So the only thing that popped into my mind instantly was something about Purim. But this, of course, was the middle of the summer, and so it became a joke that all I could think of was talking about Purim in the middle of the summer. So when I set the date for February 4th, I was not going to talk about Purim, and I took a look at the calendar, and saw that yesterday was Tu B'Shvat, and said, perfect, another holiday I could talk about. But while I was taking a look at some things, I came across an interesting piece of information, that tonight is the 17th of Shvat, and the 17th and 18th of Shvat, so tomorrow, Monday, and Tuesday, are the anniversary of something called Purim Saragossa. So, Purim Saragossa. So once again, I'm going to talk about Purim, and it's a little different than the usual Purim that we are used to. Okay. If you take a look at the first source on the source sheet, there's a pasuk in Bamidbar, which says, "Uviyom simchatchem uvemoadechem uvrasheichadcheichem," on the days of your rejoicing and on your holidays. And on the first days of your month, on Rosh Chodesh, utikaten b'chatzotzrot, you should blow horns al alotechem v'al zivchei shalmechem v'hayu lachem lezikaron lufnei elokechem ani Hashem elokechem. You should blow horns over your sacrifices and make it a very festive occasion, and it should be a memorial before Hashem. Can everyone hear me? Okay, good. Ibn Ezra comments on this verse, on the words uviyom simchatchem. What exactly are we referring to in the words on the days of our rejoicing? Ibn Ezra, in source number 2, says the following. What's uviyom simchatchem uvemoadechem? Sheshavtem me'eretz oyev, o nitzachtem ha'oyev haba aleichem. The days of your rejoicing is a day when you return from the land of the enemy, when you've been put in exile, when you return from the exile, or you have defeated the enemy that came to attack you. Ukivatem yom simcha ki yemei purim v'shivat yemei chizkiyah. And you should establish a day of rejoicing, like the days of Purim, and like the 7 days of rejoicing that King Chizkiyahu made during the time of his rule. So Ibn Ezra here establishes the concept that when we have a victory to celebrate, a victory against an enemy, we should indeed make it a day of real celebration. The Magen Avraham on the Shulchan Aruch, which is in source number 4, talks about this idea. And it's brought down in the halachot of Purim and Chanukah, or he brings it down in the halachot of Purim, because like Purim and Chanukah, which were established as celebrations over the defeats of our enemies, and so therefore we established a celebration for generations to come in commemoration of this miraculous defeat. So the Magen Avraham says that this is something that we can do as well for any type of similar type of celebration. So I brought the quotation from the Shulchan Aruch because I wanted you to see the context, but it happens not really to be connected to that exact topic right there. But if you take a look at source 4 in the Magen Avraham, and the underlined words, he says right there,
Yicholim b'nei ir letaken b'haskama uvecherem aleihem ve'al habaim acharehem la'asot purim b'yom shenasa boni. That people of a community can make an edict with a common agreement, and they can institute they can enforce an edict that would carry with it the punishment of excommunication upon themselves, those who live in the city, and all who come in the generations to follow in that city, to make certain days days of Purim in commemoration of a nes, of a miracle that occurred. So this concept, the Magen Avraham quotes a source. The Magen Avraham, who lived in the 17th century in Poland, quotes a source also from the 16th century, a tshuva that was written to Maharam Alashkar. The question that was sent to Maharam Alashkar, Moshe Alashkar, was written by a person coming from a community where they had indeed made this type of decree. Some sort of miracle had happened in the community, and the general community had decided, and the Beis Din also had decided in the community, that they were going to create a day of Purim on the anniversary of that day, and anybody living in the community, as well as any of their descendants, even if they would move out of the community, would be required to celebrate this day of celebration. And so an individual wrote a letter to Rav Moshe Alashkar asking him, does the town have the authority to do something like this? And if they do have the authority, are they allowed to make it are they allowed to make it and enforce it on future generations as well? And if they are they even allowed to enforce it once people have moved away from the town? I used to live there, or my grandparents used to live there, but now I no longer do. Do I still have to keep that day of commemoration for a miracle that occurred someplace else in that town? And so Rav Moshe Alashkar answered the Shaila, and in his tshuva he writes that yes, indeed, a community with a general agreement has the power to create a day like this, to create a Purim like this, and to enforce it on the members of the community, and to enforce it on future generations as well. He said, in this particular case that was written to him, they actually specified that it should be for future generations. But he said, even if it's not even specified for future generations, it has a force of falling on future generations as well. And so certainly in this case. And even if somebody were to move from the community, as indeed the person writing the question had moved, he said, even in this case, since they had specified that it was for those people and those descendants of the community, even once they had moved, so since it was specified, then yes, indeed, it's in force and should still be kept. And this was the tshuva that he wrote that the Magen Avraham refers to. So we see here that this day of Purim that could be enacted by a community was a serious thing. And it really had a force to it that could be kept year after year. If you take a look now at source number 6. Source number 6 is a source from the Chasam Sofer, a sefer written by Rav Moshe Sofer, who lived in the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th centuries in Germany. And he writes here, sorry, actually, go first to source number 7, also from the Chasam Sofer. He writes here in source number 7, Mihu nir'eh dehainu dafka mimita lachayim. That it's specifically regarding a miracle that occurs in connection mimita lachayim, with saving lives, that when a community or a person is saved from death and is no longer in jeopardy, is no longer in jeopardy of his life. And he says in this kind of a case, it is enforced that we can create a day like that. And it's similar to the Purim of Mordechai and Esther. But he says, with other types of dangers that are not life-threatening, it doesn't have the same kind of power. And we learn this halacha, we learn this idea, from a kal vachomer with Mordechai and Esther. He says, with Mordechai and Esther, where the whole community in Purim was saved from death, so they came along and they said, me'avdus l'cheirus omrim shira, mi'mita l'chayim lo kol shekein. If we say shira, when we've been saved from slavery, okay, as for example on Pesach, we're saved from slavery, and we have a whole holiday. Okay, is better? If on Pesach we say Shira, we have a holiday, and we say Hallel, when we were saved from slavery, Mordechai and Esther came along and said, then in a case when we're saved from a life-threatening situation, our entire community, we were threatened, we were going to be killed, shouldn't therefore, Kal Vachomer, we should certainly make a celebration, and certainly say Hallel, although we have a Megillah in place of Hallel, but certainly make a day of celebration, Yom Tov to Hashem. And so from this place, from this Kal Vachomer, we get this idea of a day of celebration, in commemoration of a nes. Of a nes mimita l'chayim. And the Chasam Sofer specifies that it has to be when it's in a life-threatening situation. Otherwise, we really should make a Yom Tov of it. So now he says in source 6, if you turn back to source number 6, he says in source 6, Umashin Amar, Dipurim v'chanaka, v'chol yimei mikilat ta'anit, la'asot zecher l'neis mimaret l'chayim, regarding Purim and Chanukah, and numerous other days that are listed in a place called Megillat Ta'anit, which is a list of various celebrations that were made for good events. It says, regarding all these days, when we make a commemoration for a nes that was when we were saved from a life-threatening situation, hu de'oraita mamash. It's a de'oraita. It's a from a de'oraita that we should make a celebration like this. And he says, mikol makom, if you skip a little bit, mikol makom, hainu la'asot shum zecher l'neis. That the de'oraita applies regarding the commemoration of the neis. To make the zecher of the neis is the de'oraita. Aval, echut v'kamut hazikaron hahu, humi derabanan. How exactly we celebrate it is derabanan. Whether we do one thing or another, whether we have a feast or something else, that's derabanan, but that we should have it, that's de'oraita. Kigon kriyat megillah u'mishloach manot v'hadlakat nerot b'chanukah, hakol mi'derabanan. The mitzvot that we have on Purim, of megillah and mishloach manot, and matanot le'avyonim, and on Chanukah of lighting the candles, that's derabanan. Aval la'asot shum zecher k'tzat, but to make some type of commemoration, and certainly at least to prohibit fasting and eulogizing and mourning, hu de'oraita mikal vachomer. That's a de'oraita. And so we have an obligation upon ourselves to commemorate any time that we are saved from death. How we commemorate it is a different story. So through the ages, there have been many Purims like this that have been set up. And they're called Purim Katan, little Purims. There are many, many of them. We don't know an exhaustive list, but the most comprehensive list is probably found in the Encyclopedia Judaica, where approximately 120 or so are listed. The common denominator among them all is that there is a prohibition of mourning, prohibition of fasting on the day of celebration. Some of them start with the day of fasting. The actual day of celebration we're not allowed to fast on, but they were not allowed to fast on. And the prohibition of saying tachanun. But the exact practices of how each specific one would be celebrated, there's no real consensus regarding these different days. Every single one had something different. But most of them were celebrated with a celebratory meal, a seuda, as well as, like in Purim, a Megillah that was written commemorating the event and that was read on that day. So for example, there was a Purim Katan called Purim Hitler. And in commemoration of this Purim Hitler, which obviously was in commemoration of the defeat of Hitler and the salvation of the Jews after the Holocaust, there was a Megillah written in commemoration of this event called Megillah to Hitler. I'll read you a little bit of it. And just listen to the language and how similar it is to Megillah Esther. Casablanca. Okay, Vayehi bimei Hitler hatzava, hu ha-corporal ha-moshel al-kol Germania, shva asrei medinot. Bayamin ha-heim, ba'lot ha-achzar hazeh al-kisei hem-shalto, asher be-Berlin ha-bira. Very similar to the Megillah. Bishnat ha-rishona le-memshalo, asa mishteh le-natsav, hu l'chol re'av. Chel Germania, ha-natsim ha-achzarim u-gdolim, הפאשיסטים אשר לפניו, להראות להם את גדול כבודו ותפארתו ואת עיקר גדולתו ורוב חכמתו. And it goes on and on, but you can hear the similarity in language. Various Megillot were written, some were not similar at all. They were written in commemoration and it didn't have to be similar to the Megillah. But some like this try to mimic the language of the Megillah, of Megillat Esther. It happens to be that regarding Purim Saragossa, which we'll get to in a little bit later, the Megillah written for Purim Saragossa is unique in that it's one of the most similar to Megillat Esther. And the language of that Megillah is really very similar to Megillat Esther. In addition, actually, just an interesting piece of information, in Megillat Saragossa, it also, in talking about the villain of the story, it mentions, every time it mentions him by name, it mentions the words Yimach Shemo V'Zichro, and that his name and memory should be erased. And this is probably the earliest, or one of the earliest references we have to that term of Yimach Shemo V'Zichro, which is taken from two different psukim. So we have this concept of Purim Katan. There are many, many throughout the ages. And they fall roughly into two types. One is Purim Katan of a tzibur, where it fell upon a community, some sort of disaster was about to fall upon a community, and the community was saved, and they enacted a commemoration. And another type was a Purim Tiyachi, where a disaster, a life-threatening situation, fell upon an individual, and that individual commemorated the salvation from that situation with a Purim for himself, sometimes for his family and generations after him. So just to give you a couple of examples of the different types of Purims, I want to start with an example of a Purim Katan D'Yachid, a Purim that was established by an individual. Take a look at source number 8. Source number 8 comes from a Sefer HaPalacha called Sefer Charedim, which was written in the late 16th century by Rabbi Elazar Azkari, who lived in Tzfat. And in the course of whatever halacha he was discussing there, he wrote about an event that happened to the Rambam. The Rambam lived from approximately 1140 to 1205. I rounded the dates a little bit. He was born in Spain and moved to Morocco. And then as a result of certain persecutions, most likely religious persecutions in Morocco, he left Morocco and took a boat to Eretz Israel. And the Rambam wrote, and the Rabbi Azkari writes in Sefer Charedim, that the Rambam got on this boat on the 14th of Iyar, and 6 days later there was a terrible, terrible storm. And everyone thought they were doomed. And the boat was going to capsize. And the storm continued for approximately, 2 days. The Rambam during this time made a neder, made an oath to spend his time davening to Hashem. And he spent the 2 days davening by himself to Hashem. And he made an oath that in the future, all of his family and future generations should also do the same on those 2 days. Or that he certainly should do that same on those 2 days, and his children should also commemorate the event. He got on the boat on the 14th of Iyar. It took approximately 1 month until he got to Eretz Yisrael. So they arrived in Eretz Yisrael about a month later. And obviously, he was saved. The boat did not capsize, and he was saved. And he made, as part of his neder, that every year on the anniversary of that day, just like he spent the day in tefillah, davening to Hashem, without talking to anybody, he thought his life was going to be lost. So every year on the anniversary of that day, he would spend it alone in a room, davening by himself, not talking to anybody unless he was absolutely forced to. And then he said also that he made it upon his children forever that they should celebrate the anniversary of that day by giving tzedakah and by having a mishteh, having a suda, a celebratory meal, and celebration in commemoration of the day that he was saved from death. So this is an example of a personal Purim. Another example of a personal Purim is found in Source 9. It's in a Sefer Chaye Adam, which was written in the late 18th and early 19th centuries by Rabbi Avraham Danzig, who lived in Poland. He writes about his personal story that happened to him, which he calls his personal pulver Purim, okay, or powder Purim, after gunpowder. He writes that in Vilna in 1804, he lived in a courtyard with a number of other houses. And what occurred was that somehow some gunpowder was ignited, and there's a tremendous explosion and tremendous fire. And if you skim through this, we're not going to really read through it now, but if you skim through this, he writes in detail how people in his family were seriously hurt. He writes that various walls of his house collapsed. His wife and daughter were in one room, and his daughter, a wall fell on her, and she almost lost her life. His wife was hit in the face by some falling beams and was seriously, seriously injured. His son and himself were somewhere else in another part of the house, and the walls there also fell, the windows blew in, and his son was hurt badly in his back, and he himself was also hurt as well. And he said that there was not a person in his household who did not lose blood, who was not bleeding from that event. And Hashem took that blood as if it was the blood of a korban. And while they were so seriously hurt, they all survived the incident, while 31 other people in the courtyard were killed. And he writes that in commemoration of that event, on the anniversary of that day, they would have a Purim, they would have a celebration, and they would make a Seudah, and they would have the Seudah not only for themselves, but also for other Talmidei Chachamim. They would invite anyone who's Talmud or in Torah to come and join in the Seudah, and they would also make it a practice to give tzedakah on that day. And this would be preceded, like with Purim, by a fast day, the day before. Okay, so the day before, meaning during the day, they would have a fast. So the Hebrew date before, they would fast during the day, and then later on at night, they would have their Seudah. Again, another example of a personal Purim. I don't know how many of you are from the Teaneck area, but for those of you who are from the Teaneck area, do get Teaneck Shuls. It's an email group that goes out to the general Teaneck community with events that go on in Teaneck. And For a number of years, I've noticed, and I guess I've been mildly curious, approximately this time of year, I guess, Rosh Chodesh Adar, there's usually a posting that goes out to all descendants of Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller with a reminder that shortly is approaching the day of his personal Purim that he enacted for all of his descendants, and that it should be celebrated in the following way by giving a certain amount of money for tzedakah. I don't recall, because I wasn't paying as much attention a few years ago, whether they have a suga on that day or not, but I imagine they might. But Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller was the chief rabbi of Bohemia in 1627. And there was a heavy tax on the Jews, and he was in charge of monitoring it. And so there were some who were very angry at him, because he had to make the assessments of who should pay and how much. And so some people slandered him to the king by saying that if you read between the lines in his Sfarim, in the books that he wrote, you would see a criticism of Christianity. So he was brought before the king and he was put on trial, and he was sentenced to a fine and imprisonment of 15 years. He really should have been put to death. That was how severe the crime was. But instead he was sentenced to 15 years in jail. And he made a fast day for the family on the 5th of Tammuz. Finally, the whole thing ended when he became the chief rabbi of Krakow in 1644. And on the anniversary of that date, he made a family Purim, which apparently is still even being kept until this day, or at least a year ago when I last saw the posting on Teaneck Shoals. So that was another example, and a very current example, of a Purim Katan. So the Purim that I wanted to specifically talk about, the Purim Katan of a Rabin, of a community, that I wanted to talk about, the anniversary of which is tonight and tomorrow night, is Purim Saragossa. Saragossa was a community in northeast Spain, in the Kingdom of Aragon. There is a little bit of debate as to when exactly Purim Saragossa occurred. Different sources have it occurring in 1480, some have it in 1420, I even saw one 1440, but somewhere in that time frame. And what occurred was, Saragossa was a city of approximately 200,000 people, of which approximately 6%, so it's about 1,200 people, were Jewish. And they had always enjoyed close relations with the Gentiles in the area, the Christians, and hadn't had any major problems. But things in Spain were getting a little more tense. And in the year 1391, there were terrible anti-Jewish persecutions in Spain. And as a result, many, many Jews left Saragossa, many others converted to Christianity, and it took its effect on the community of Saragossa. In the year 1414, there was a disputation of Tortosa. Okay? The disputation of Tortosa, for those of you who've heard of the disputation, which Ramban participated in many, many, 200 years earlier, where Ramban had to defend the Torah and the Gemara against critique from others. It was a similar disputation, except that they didn't have anybody in Ramban's caliber to dispute for them. And what happened in this disputation was that a person who was very, very familiar with the Gemara and Jewish sources came and accused the Jews of attacking Christianity and other crimes. The dispute, and the Jews sent very worthy members of their community, the dispute was so intense and so difficult that it lasted for 68 sessions, and it spanned a year and 9 months. At the end of it, well, the way it worked is that if the Jews lost, they were condemned to death or to forced conversion. But fortunately for them, they won. And at the end of it, they were saved. Still, though, it's had a tremendous impact on the community of Zaragoza. Many, many important people, leaders of the community, and certainly many others, converted to Christianity. Among them, many important rabbis and other leaders of the community. And so the number of Jews in the ranks was diminished. And at the time of Purim Zaragoza, which we'll say approximately 1420, there were about 200 Jewish families living in Zaragoza. Now, what would generally happen was when the king would come to Zaragoza, and Zaragoza was a summer residence for the king. When he would come to Zaragoza, they would all go out to greet him and have a big parade. And there were 12 shuls in Zaragoza. And as part of the celebration for the king, part of their way of honoring the king, they would take the Sifrei Torah out of their shuls, and they would all dance in front of the king with the Sifrei Torah from the 12 shuls. It was in Spain. These were Sephardi Sifrei Torah, and they have hard cases. And so one year they decided that the Jews decided they didn't feel it was so respectful to the Sifrei Torah to bring them out for such a secular celebration. And so they were just going to keep the Sifrei Torah in the shul, the scrolls themselves inside the shul, and they were just going to take the cases out in celebration of the king. But nobody would really know, because, I mean, we would know if they were Ashkenaz ones, so there wouldn't be anything there. But here was a hard case, nobody would know it was inside. And so that's what they did. It's unclear whether they actually did this as a practice for more than at all, really. But there was one Jew who was an informer. And he got wind of the plan, either by knowing what happened previously or by, you know, in a previous year, or by just hearing them talking of it. And so he went and told the king that the Jews were going to do this, and that would be a great disrespect to the king. The king, understandably, was infuriated. And he said to Marcos was the informer, he said, when we come to the parade, you're going to check all the Sifrei Torah. And if what you see is correct, the entire community will be put to death. Came the day of the parade, and the Jews were lined up in the streets with Sifrei Torah from the 12 shuls. And all of a sudden, the king announced, I want those cases open. And everybody panicked, because everybody knew there was nothing inside. When they opened the cases, lo and behold, there was a Sifrei Torah. What had happened? The night before, the shamash in the shul, and some sources say each shamash in each of the 12 shuls, had a dream. And in the dream, Eliyahu Hanavi came to him and told him to put the Sefer Torah back into the case for some reason. When the shamash woke up in the morning, he didn't have time to tell the people what the dream was about, but he quickly went and put the Sefer Torah back in the case. And so did the shamashes of all of the 12 shuls, because they all had the same dream. And then, at the parade, when the king had those Sifrei Torah opened up, Sifrei Torah, the cases all contained the actual scrolls, and the plan was foiled. The informer was then hanged. And that's how the community of Zaragoza was saved. The informer was hanged. The king issued an edict that for 3 years the community would be spared from taxes, and did other measures to try to make up for what he had been planning to do to the community. And so it was a day of tremendous celebration, the 17th and 18th of Shvat, for the community of Zaragoza, which they then commemorated every year with a celebration of Seuda feast and by reading a Megillah, Megillat Zaragoza. Interestingly, the last line from the Megillah, like we say in our Megillah, Arur Haman, Asher Bikesh L'Abdi, Baruch Mordechai HaYehudi, the last line of their Megillah is Arur Marcos HaRasha, Baruch Ephraim Shamash, Arurim Kol HaRishaim, Bruchim Kol Yisrael, V'gam Eliyahu HaNavi Zachur Latov. Cursed is Marcus the wicked, blessed is Ephraim the Shamash. Cursed are all the wicked ones, and blessed is all of Israel. And also Eliyahu Hanavi is remembered for good. And so we hear the similarity also with Megillat Zaragoza to our Megillah of Purim. And this day of Purim Zaragoza was celebrated by all the inhabitants of Zaragoza and all their descendants, even once they had moved, even as recently as the 1950s, like probably even past that, but even as recently as the 1950s, they were still celebrating it in various communities around the world, wherever these Jews from Zaragoza had moved to once they had been exiled to Spain. One community of which was in Yemin Moshe in Yerushalayim, where they every year had a celebration and read Megillat Zaragoza. And so I leave you with this little thought about Purim, and thank you all for coming, and wish you all a happy Purim Zaragoza.